I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, "Yes, I'm black. I'm proud of it. I'm black and beautiful."
The civic heroism of Martin Luther King Jr. marks a peak in any history of 20th century America. We're listening this hour for the rest of the story. The basics are familiar. At his death by assassination 50 years ago, he was then just 39 years old, Dr. King had been the incandescent voice in a 15-year civil rights movement that wrote race out of our law. He is remembered for it on the holiday calendar, in monuments and street names and avenues, in hundreds of cities and towns across the land, on postage stamps around the world. This hour, we're listening for what is not on the MLK stamps or in the civics books: the religious conviction, the radicalism about wealth and power. The labor historian Michael Honey strikes a keynote for all of us. If we know Dr. King by his "I Have a Dream" speech on the Mall in Washington, 1963, we may well be missing the man and the point.
The problem is that the general public is still going on the "I Have a Dream" speech of 1963, which is a marvelous speech, but people don't put it in context. And they tend to see King as an advocate for colorblind American capitalism. That appeals to a very diverse audience, and very often commercial interests and politicians and so forth. And so the way King gets translated to a lot of young people is like, well, that was the civil rights movement that was over and we solved that problem. And as they always say, but we have a long way to go. Well, that is hardly enough to understand the prophetic vision of King. If you only see King as, quote, a civil rights leader, then you're missing more than half of the story.
Michael Honey, help us recalibrate a very complicated character. And I'm thinking specifically, he's a PhD intellectual. He's a campaigner on an almost Napoleonic scale. He's a radical about rights and justice, and he's also a Christian saint.
Well, the first thing to know about King, in my opinion, is that he's the grandson of slaves and the son of sharecroppers who moved to the city and became ministers and built Ebenezer Baptist Church. He's a third generation coming along who is raised during the Great Depression, born in 1929. And graduates from Morehouse University around 1944-45. His education as a postgraduate student and then a PhD student at Boston University is very important. It gave him tremendous training, probably more training than almost any other preacher of the time, not just black preachers, but white preachers as well. So that's all very important. But the way King talked about it is he talked about himself as the son of slaves and sharecroppers, and he talked about the movement as a movement to create a second emancipation. So his March on Washington speech in 1963, "I Have a Dream," was aimed at trying to get the Kennedy administration to start a second emancipation, which would be not only for civil rights and voting rights, which they were still fighting for in 63, but also economic justice. And King talked about this all the way through. It wasn't new. A lot of times people think, oh, we have the civil rights King from 55, the Montgomery bus boycott, to the Voting Rights Act in 65, the Civil Rights Act in 64. That's the King that most people are familiar with. From 65 to 68, we have his campaign in Chicago to desegregate the urban centers of the North. And we have his Poor People's Campaign to try to get the country to reprioritize from spending for war to spending for jobs and education for all, health care for all, housing for all. It was a campaign to wipe out poverty. And then, of course, his very strong stand against the Vietnam War, where he stood up against Lyndon Johnson and all the forces in power about American imperialism. And then last, his stand for the Memphis sanitation workers in 1968, where he was killed.
Yeah, we need to be reminded that the I Have a Dream speech was never the end. It was almost an opening round. We know that. I've been to the mountaintop speech the night before he was killed. Tell us what he was doing there in Memphis. Why sanitation workers?
He had a long relationship with organized labor, and it started with the Montgomery bus boycott when the left wing of the labor movement in the industrial unions, like the United Packing House Workers Union and others, came to King's support during that Montgomery bus boycott. He spoke to most of the major unions in the country between 1955 and 1968, and he had strong relationships with public employee unions, with hospital workers' unions, with distributive workers, people in the cities. So he went beyond unions to a campaign for poor people. And the Poor People's Campaign was an attempt to sort of bridge the gap between organized labor and the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, with the idea that we can all unite around ending poverty in America. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that campaign, he was called to Memphis by James Lawson, a great supporter of labor rights himself in Memphis, to support the sanitation workers who were in 6 weeks of a strike against the city of Memphis. And he came to Memphis with almost no preparation, but he gave this marvelous speech on March 18th, 1968, which laid out the basic issues for poor people, that it's a crime for people to live in this rich country and receive starvation wages. It sounds like he's talking about the fight for $15 an hour today. He's really talking about the right of workers to organize today. He's talking about the interconnection between poverty and anti-union forces today.
He's talking in a way also about the 1%.
Yes. In a number of his labor speeches, he even uses the phrase, the 1%.
Really?
Yes. These issues that we're dealing with today are not new. You know, American capitalism has always been raw and exploitive, and particularly on the racial side, oppressive to people of color, and especially African Americans. And started out in slavery, which you can't get any cheaper wages than slavery. And so King was fighting this all his life.
Yeah, the labor radical, the critic of capitalism, is not on that postage stamp. But there's another piece I'd love you to comment on, and that is of a passionately convicted religious man who sees himself taking up the cross of the crucified God-man and following him.
Yeah. Well, again, the Martin Luther King papers at Stanford have provided us a great source of material on King's black social gospel. Martin was following that from his father, who people call Daddy King, who also was named Martin Luther King Sr. Daddy King was following Luke in the Bible, the Jesus command, you know, to serve the poor, serve the weak. And King thoroughly took that into his understanding of Christianity at a very young age and preached that his whole life through. And of course, as Cornel West would say, you know, the black church was where you learned to take care of other people. It was social service. It was taking care of homeless kids. It was building a political community for the right to vote. And Ebenezer Baptist Church did all of those things under King's father, Daddy King, and under King himself when he became the leader of that church.
Dr. King loved to tell a Good Samaritan story. Can you give us the radio version?
The Good Samaritan story is the man going down Jericho Road from Jericho to Jerusalem, traveling down a dangerous highway, and people traveling down this road being afraid to stop to help anyone, and a man left by the side of the road who'd been beaten and robbed. The ministers passed him by, the rich people passed him by. Who finally stopped to help the man was a Samaritan, somebody of a different race who was looked down upon. King, seeing it as a kind of a equivalent of a black American, stopping to help a white American who had been robbed and beaten and saving that person's life. Well, he uses that story in his last speech in Memphis. He calls on people to practice what he calls dangerous unselfishness, that people think that self-preservation is the first law of life. He said, no, other preservation is the first law of life. If you don't help the other, then you too will be victimized. And what he was essentially calling on in Memphis was for the middle class to join with the working class to solve this strike. It was very specific what he was trying to get people to do. But beyond that was the larger story, which is that you die on the cross. King had that image in his mind all along, that that is what would happen to him, and he accepted that.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
To the Promised Land is the title of Michael Honey's new book on Martin Luther King and the fight for economic justice, due in the first week of April. Professor Honey teaches history at the University of Washington in Tacoma. Coming up, Martin Luther King, the scholar, writer, thinker. This is Open Source. On the mind inside the voice of Martin Luther King Jr., the ideas inside that language. The scholar's complaint is that though King Day is now ritual, the weight of the man's intellect is neglected. That shelf of books and articles he wrote on human dignity, justice, history. Brandon Terry, the Harvard humanist and professor of African American studies, is one of 15 essayists in a collection just out on MLK, The Philosopher in Motion.
I think oftentimes we have a conception of King as an activist, or we invoke him as a symbol of a kind of Christ-like sacrificial figure. Less frequently we refer to his intellectual output. But for him, I think all of those things hung together. Now, he gave this eulogy for W.E.B. Du Bois on the 100th anniversary of Du Bois' birth in New York City right before he died, a couple of weeks before he was assassinated. And there he has this really striking phrase. He says, Du Bois combined the intellectual and the activist, right? It's a thing that he really holds on to. And then he also has this line. He says, Du Bois was a genius and chose to be a communist. So the way I hold those lines together is that sometimes really critical, reflective thought about the social problems that we face may lead you to radical solutions or controversial, counterintuitive ideas. But those ideas are going to be at work in the best kind of activism, right? Ideas are going to inform the activism. The activism is going to inform the ideas. And it's only in the meeting of those two that you can muster the insight and wisdom and courage to make the kind of sacrifices that King was willing to make, because he saw a way forward. He saw things that were worth dying for. He distilled those moral ideals and was able to impart them and share them with the people he labored with in the civil rights struggle to kind of hold each other up in their joint willingness to sacrifice.
On this matter of the intellectual project of his life, you take up a line and disagree with it from Cass Sunstein, in which he says that you can think of his King's civil rights project as a sort of conservative undertaking to go back to the fundamentals of the Constitution and clean it up and repair it and make it whole for all people. And yet you don't, that's not your line. You see him in a much more original venture to write something new and to create something new, define something new. What was that?
Well, I think the conservative backward-looking framework trains our judgment in a certain way. It trains how we read King, how we study the civil rights movement, and it trains our attention so that we look for certain things and don't notice things that are sitting there right in front of us, right? So if you go back to, just to take one example, if you go back to the early speeches from Montgomery, King often doesn't mention the founding charters at all. He describes Montgomery as part of a worldwide revolution, a worldwide uprising against white supremacy that is of a piece with the struggle against colonialism in Africa, Asia, India. And I mention all of that because, you know, if we treat the sort of existing constitutional order as a stable arbiter for African-American political aspirations, particularly right. the ones of the civil rights movement, we start to take certain things for granted that King precisely did not, right? He thought we really needed to radically rethink American federalism, that the kind of concessions we make to existing municipal boundaries were going to always be a blockage in the way of the integrationist future that he hoped to bring about. He thought that our militarism and the way we organized our solidarities with other countries was deeply flawed and needed a kind of moral reinvigoration and a sense of moral maturity to rethink our antagonistic relationships with other nations and other peoples around the world. These are things that I don't think come out when you assume he's just redeeming the original project.
Brandon, reintroduce Martin Luther King Jr. as an intellectual. How do we see this man? Laboring over text. I also want to know, what company was he joining when he got into that mode? Who were his ideals? Who were his rivals? Who was he speaking to?
So what that project really entails for me is a kind of attempt to justify one's actions in public to potential allies and other members of this society. And so when you're asking people, and we don't think about this enough, it's like activism is asking people to risk a lot. Right. Particularly when you're confronting the kind of resilient, vicious form of domination that went by the name Jim Crow. You know, he goes to Birmingham. He says to his advisors, everybody's not going to come home. Some of us won't leave Birmingham. He himself did not leave Memphis. Right. And when you ask people to risk that level of security, safety, goods that they've managed to cobble together in an unjust society, you've got to give them reasons. They've got to know, why are we doing what we're doing? What's guiding us? What principles do we make decisions based on? Right? And that's, again, about this question of respecting people as people who can act on the basis of reasons, people who have rational judgment, people who aren't just going to be moved and governed by the lowest passion or base rhetorical appeals. It's making an argument. So I think that's really crucial. And in doing that, I think he's joining a long tradition of public Christian intellectuals. You know, he was obviously deeply influenced by Niebuhr, Howard Thurman, author of Jesus and the Disinherited, and also the African-American tradition, right? He's constantly invoking W.E.B. Du Bois. He's obviously familiar with and influenced in certain respects by James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison. But he's drawing from that tradition of, you know, people who are trying to move at once in the register of philosophy and politics and chart a way forward, give reasons for it, appeal to fellow participants in that struggle, and justify going this way instead of the way of other folks who are clamoring for their allegiance and solidarity as well.
I wish you'd recap that argument around black nationalism, because in hindsight, it seems that the differences between Stokely Carmichael and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and various branches of the movement, they were not insignificant, but they were thin compared to the agreement, compared to, for one thing, the honoring of Martin Luther King as himself, the sort of the spear point, but also there was a single project.
I mean, Malcolm's really complicated because, as the Manning Marable biography shows, he lives a life of reinvention. He's changing himself throughout. But if you take Malcolm X from the classical Nation of Islam period, right? When he first comes to prominence, you think Mike Wallace documentary, The Hate That Hate Produced, right? That kind of era of Malcolm X. I think it's a great contrast because, you know, classical Nation of Islam doctrine, for instance, is in no way troubled by capitalism. Like, the view is that actually what we need is a separate black economy, right? That reparations need to be given, land needs to be granted so that black people can kind of participate in the same sorts of capitalist enterprises, wealth creation,
it's so interesting.
Pursuit of national greatness, quote unquote, as other nations. And that the problem is we're being denied that, right? King, particularly the mature King, doesn't think of capitalism that way, right? You can pick almost any Malcolm X speech from the 50s, and he's inveighing against people who are dependent, quote unquote, on welfare, right? And people who've lost their sense of self-respect and dignity by being on welfare. King, on the other hand, is saying the structure of the modern economy is such that it produces endemic unemployment, whether people want it or not. And we need to secure, for the question of people's basic dignity, some kind of standard guaranteed income or guaranteed work, and that there's nothing undignified about that.
Are you at odds with the romantic narrative? And what's the other way of looking at it?
Right now, we have such a dramatically pessimistic reaction to the kind of romantic story about civil rights, about the Obama administration that we're told for so long, that many people of my generation are now obsessed with the kind of pessimism that doesn't actually track, you know, I think the contours of what political life really looks like.
Brandon, take that apart. Who's your generation? Which disappointments are you talking about? And which agendas looking forward?
Well, so I think my generation are people who kind of in their late 20s to late 30s. And they're people who grew up off a romantic narrative of the civil rights struggle that was reinvigorated, I think, in many quarters by the election of Barack Obama. And that the Obama campaign in particular, and often his administration, you know, explicitly narrated themselves as the realization or triumph of the civil rights struggle, right? So Obama says, I'm a member of the Joshua generation, right? So King is Moses, died before reaching the promised land, but we have, in fact, reached the promised land, and we will achieve the ends and aims of that struggle. You know, those are the speeches he gives at Philadelphia, at Selma, at Morehouse. And when that kind of rhetoric ran headlong into, you know, the intractability of racial injustice, the limits of Obama's own peculiar and not very king-like attempt to deal with those sorts of questions of racial injustice, economic injustice, and certainly militarism.
Yeah,
it couldn't be farther apart on that question.
In your book, Cornel West, in his essay, says that the memory of King, the legacy of King, was his fundamental motivation for fierce criticism of President Obama after the administration got going. I don't think it was on the rights issues or justice issues so much as on the fundamental economic issues, the bailouts, the connection to Wall Street, but especially the extension of the war from Iraq into Afghanistan. I mean, do we understand yet how that happened? What piece of the King legacy did Obama forget?
Well, this is what I was going to say, is that I think Cornell is also really worried about the integrity of symbols. You might think that even if you disagreed with President Obama about any number of things, that there's a separate question about whether President Obama should have draped himself in the legacy of Martin Luther King to do the various kinds of work that he did, right? So let me just give you one kind of concrete example of, I think, a failure or something where President Obama failed to learn and could have actually done something quite different. And this doesn't even deal with the kind of reaction he faces in Congress or from the Republicans. But the one of the first foreign policy questions the Obama administration faced involved the Somali pirates. So,
remind us.
Yeah. And so early in the administration, there were a group of pirates off the coast of East Africa who had traditionally been fishermen, but as European fishing vessels, primarily from France, had come through, they had destroyed, utterly destroyed the fishing stocks of these nations, particularly Somalia, ruining the livelihood of these fishermen and violating international law, right? They're in nations' waters that aren't their own, fishing in ways that are illegal. And in retaliation, these fishermen off East Africa start hijacking shipping vessels. And one of the first questions that Obama faces is he has one of these crises that he has to negotiate where the pirates have captured a vessel. They're holding people hostage for ransom.
Are we in a Tom Hanks movie?
The movie was based on.
Okay,
on
go ahead.
Things. And, instead of drawing European countries to the table to discuss the violation of international law, defending the rights of East Africans to have their territorial integrity respected, bringing down the force of the United States on behalf of those questions, reframing these issues for the broader public to think about. The move was made to look tough on questions of quote unquote terrorism and assassinate those fishermen. To me, that was a decisive moment because it was about a kind of political performance of toughness, of projecting strength. That was nothing like that. If you read King's speech against the Vietnam War, not the famous Riverside one, but the one he gives in Los Angeles a couple of weeks before that, yes. He talks about the virtue of maturity there and that the things that we think of as these like projections of strength, these ideals that we're living up to, they're all hollow idols. They're not as real as we think they are. Mm-hmm. The real strength, the real maturity would have been to try to restage these questions and move the world order, particularly at that time when he had enormous political capital around the world coming off of the Bush disaster, and try to move the world toward a more just relation, right? Even if that meant allying yourself with the most weak, the most vulnerable, that's what the kind of King sacrifice would have been. And that was the perfect time to do it.
What would Dr. King be observing and saying to Black Lives Matter?
I think he'd be really moved by those who emphasize these questions of economic justice, who connect the militarized policing and brutality in the United States to militarism abroad. I think he'd be less enamored and more frustrated with those who try to treat racism or white supremacy as a catch-all explanation for all forms of black disadvantage and racial inequality. He was usually more precise about the sources of that. I think he'd also be worried about those wings of the movement that tip a little too close into what he objected to in the Black Power movement, which is making a kind of metaphysical basis for Black identity and indulging in kinds of anger that work to cause you to lose track of sympathy and suffering for other people. And so you'll sometimes hear these phrases like, one of the jokes on, it'll come on Black Twitter, it's like white tears. At some level, it's ironic and you get the deflating use of it. So, in certain cases, it's perfectly fine. But when that starts to veer into things like, I look out at the opiate epidemic and my only response to it is not one of humane recognition and sympathy and a call for justice and aid and mercy. It's one that says, well, they didn't respond to the crack cocaine epidemic like that.
Yeah, we don't hear much about the beloved community these days.
Well, I think it goes back to a question about the relationship between ideals and practices, right? So when King writes about all labor having dignity, right?
Yeah.
So all labor has dignity, and he's down in Memphis at the sanitation workers' strike. And he says, the garbage man is just as important as the doctor in their labor, right? Because if we're here to defeat disease, it's just as important to have sanitation as it is to have people who can kind of treat diseases at this very professional and scientific level, right? That they're all working together to create a cooperative atmosphere where people can flourish. He's always talking about his struggle in encompassing the PhDs and the no Ds, right? So he's very attuned to all the subtle ways in which we construct hierarchies of value. And I say all that to say, that part of how you defeat the beloved community is you tear away at the very idea of cooperation and day-to-day practices and habits, right? So if people feel like, you know, they're watching everybody cobble together $70,000 a year to go to private school and to elite colleges, to have $3,000 a month daycares like we have in Boston, people see that and they know there are people who are opting out of the very idea of cooperation, right? That they're trying to load the deck entirely in their own favor, right? That they've set up a game that's rigged basically from birth, right? And people can kind of look at that and see, well, if it's not about fairness, if it's not about cooperation, if it's not about equal opportunity, a kind of cynicism sets in that we're all really in it for ourselves. And I think that's what's happened to those ideals in our society, that they need a kind of tethering. So you can't just invoke it in a void, right? It has to always be tethered to the idea that, like, this is what it would take to instantiate a beloved community. And these things are possible because, right? But it's about connecting the beloved community, our moral language, back to these concrete practices.
With his Harvard colleague, the philosopher Tommy Shelby, Brandon Terry edited the collection titled To Shape a New World, Essays on the Political Philosophy of Martin Luther King Jr. Coming up, the Reverend William Barber in North Carolina with a voice that will remind you of Dr. King's on what it would take to revive that poor people's campaign. This is Open Source. In Boston, where MLK did his PhD studies, there's always been, for me, a mysterious earthly, heavenly aura about the man. It was around him when he arrived at age 22. Michael Haynes witnessed it as King's fellow apprentice preacher at the 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury in 1951. This was before the civil rights movement had been glimpsed, but the two young aspiring black men and ministers felt something coming, as Reverend Haynes testifies, into his 90s.
I think for any black, north or south, realizing that there's strictures, there's limitations, we're still being kept out, we're still being separated, and there's something grossly wrong with the separation. And these walls, these barriers need to be broken down. And I think a lot of young leaders, probably including myself, were just waiting for God to appoint a Moses. The time was just right. And Martin was that man that was going to lead us to a promised land.
Was it obvious to you when you met Martin Luther King that this was somebody special?
Yes, very definitely, very definitely. The first time he preached at 12th Baptist Church, September 1951, for a man a year and 7 months younger than I realized that this was going to be a significant African American and a significant religious leader in the United States. So he had all of these mentors. And I think everywhere he went, he would be looking for these people that had their pulse on national and international concerns and issues. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that they certainly included the concerns of freeing black people from the oppression that they were under and freeing America from the cancer that was destroying it. It's mm-hmm. tragic when a body has a systemic cancer and doesn't realize it, hasn't been diagnosed, hasn't been brought out to them. And I think Dr. King made that diagnosis very, very clear to America. Mm-hmm. It really, really had to do with the issues of love. And in his book, The Trumpet of Conscience, that he speaks about the dependency that everybody has on one another. I think he called it the interdependent structure of all reality, that you can't do without us, we can't do without you, kind of thing. And the nations of the world are dependent on one another, and we need to see this. And he, of course, his ultimate dream was to see a beloved community, a time when in the world we would study war no more. And that was the vision that was burning inside of him even then.
That was Michael E. Haynes at home in Boston, pastor emeritus of the 12th Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King broke in with him as a student preacher in 1951. Reverend William J. Barber II is a modern exemplar of the prophetic teaching-preaching tradition in African-American Christian churches. He's been a pastor in Goldsboro, North Carolina for 25 years, and now he's a visiting professor of policy and social action at Union Theological Seminary in New York. He is often mentioned and measured as the sort of man to pick up the King mantle. I asked the Reverend Dr. Barber this week what it would take to re-inhabit that role.
Well, I think that, first of all, it is hard to understand Dr. King without understanding the years and years of liberation movement from the abolitionists, even the white abolitionists, who said things like Henry Thoreau, when somebody asked him, would he repent of his actions? And he said, the only thing I will repent of is for not asking sooner what demon possessed me to be quiet so long in the face of such injustice. Or where Frederick Douglass had the courage in the middle of slavery to say he loved the Christianity of Jesus but hated the religion of the slave master. You have to look at King's legacy through that lens, through the lens of the prophets in the Bible. And you know, the prophets in the Bible only came to the fore when the cultists and the priests weren't doing their jobs. And sometimes, you know, we try to tame Dr. King and domesticate Dr. King. And many people try to do that who preach this false brand of so-called white evangelicalism. But in the prophets, for instance, Isaiah said something like this: woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights. So when you hear Dr. King talk about three evils, racism, about materialism, militarism, he's directly quoting the biblical prophets. Or when you have, for instance, Ezekiel saying that your politicians have become like wolves and your preachers are covering up for them. Or when you hear Dr. King challenge what he called moderates, religious people, who would tell him to wait and slow down. Or lastly, when you hear Jesus say that those who don't care for the poor, the least of these, the stranger, the sick, in terms of public policy. And when Jesus said he will say to the nations, not the individuals, but to the nation, you know, if you don't do these things, then you will be utterly destroyed. So you hear Dr. King in his last sermon that he was going to preach, America is going to hell if she doesn't deal with these three issues of systemic racism, systemic poverty, and militarism. I think you have to look at all of those traditions, the depth of those traditions, to even begin to penetrate the life of Dr. King.
As you speak, I'm thinking just that dimension of spiritual language, but steeped in the language of prophecy, but the language of belief, the language of spiritual crisis. We don't know how to talk about it, it seems to me, in this country anymore.
Well, that is one of the great tragedies, and what I'm deeply concerned about with the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival, is that we've had a hijacking of our deep moral traditions by the corporate world and by Christian nationalism. Now, this is not new. The slave master religion hijacked the moral conversation to justify slavery. In the 1930s, corporations paid off and bought preachers to challenge the New Deal because they couldn't do it because they had ruined the country with the Great Depression. So if you look at Kevin Cruz's book, for instance, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Bought the Christian Pulpit, then you see that has happened in this country before. And even in Dr. King's day, you know, that his own denomination put him out. Then you had the rise of the moral majority. You had the rise of things like Falwell and Pat Robertson, and even Franklin Graham, and even Billy Graham had to admit that he had to repent that he had been wrong on these issues. So one of the things we have to have, if we're going to deal with the realities in this country, we cannot, and Dr. King would not have allowed this, have a moral conversation. And whether that conversation grows out of your deep religious faith or it grows out of a deep commitment to the moral principle of the Constitution, you can't have a moral conversation that says the only moral concerns are where you stand on abortion, where you stand on homosexuality, being pro-gun, pro-tax cuts, pro-ending entitlements, and you claim that those are the moral issues. Dr. King would say no. He would say your budget is a moral issue. health care is a moral issue. How we treat children is a moral issue. In fact, he would really say to us that any time you have a religion that says nothing about the policies that damn men and women's souls, it is a good-for-nothing religion. For instance, in Christianity and Judaism, if you combine the Old and New Testament, there are more than 2,500 scriptures that talk about how we treat the poor, the least of these, the immigrant, and those on the margins as being the cornerstones of any deep religious faith. In fact, one of my professors used to say to us that whatever you call yourself, to have a religious experience, if it doesn't produce a quarrel with the world and a quarrel with injustice, then your claim to spirituality is deeply suspect. But let's just say you're not a person of religious faith, but you look at our Constitution. Our Constitution gives us a series of moral prescriptions for the nation. Number one, it's not about individuals. That we're supposed to be a nation about the we. Number two, we're supposed to be a nation that can admit we're not a perfect nation. We don't just walk around always claiming exceptionalism and that we're better than everybody, that kind of arrogant. It says we're striving to be a more perfect union, which is an admittance we're not perfect. Then we're supposed to be about ensuring domestic tranquility, not xenophobia and racism and division and tearing people apart and building walls, but domestic tranquility. Then we're supposed to be about establishing justice and promoting the general welfare. So welfare is a constitutional word, and yet we allowed some people to make that a word we almost don't hear in the public sphere. And if we do that, according to our Constitution, then we have a liberty or a freedom that is worthy of being passed on to our posterity and subsequent generation. And the problem is, we have 140 million people who are poor, extreme poor, working poor, and over 30 million people without health care, and we're spending 60-some cents of every discretionary dollar on the war economy and militarism, and people can buy unleaded gas, but they can't buy unleaded water, and we have voter suppression in some ways like we haven't seen since Jim Crow. We have a moral malady, not merely a left versus right or a Democratic versus Republican problem, but we have a deep moral malady that must be changed.
Brother Barber, you tell a wonderful story in the Atlantic magazine about Dr. King coming to Marks, Mississippi, and seeing naked children, hungry American children, didn't have a blanket to put over them on a cold night. And Dr. King's reaction, as you report it, was, God does not like this. Jesus weeps, in effect. And that kind of God language puts some people off. It's a solvent in talking to many other people. I mean, how do we use that language in a modern way that builds a coalition, not disrupts it? And I ask because so many people say there is no Dr. King without faith.
But we have to look at the kind of faith. Dr. King's faith was rooted in the deep principles of justice. But Dr. King also preached a sermon in Montgomery where he declared that Gandhi was the greatest Christian he'd ever seen in terms of principles. And that's how you preach it. You don't lift up, you have to be a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Unitarian. What you talk about is these deep principles, and that however you name God, the fact of the matter is you must believe that there is an eternal discontent for when we disregard people, when we allow poverty to exist, not only in the United States, but in the world, in a world that is made sufficient for all of us. And the way we bring it forward is by letting people know that it still exists today. One of the things we're doing in the campaign is we've written and have an audit we'll be releasing on April the 10th called The Souls of Poor Folk, Auditing America 50 Years After the Poor People's Campaign. We call it The Souls of Poor Folk because we are saying that people have an intrinsic and an inalienable value that is not connected to money, and that people who are poor or like the homeless white teenagers that I visited out in Washington State recently that has one of the zip codes with the highest number of white millennials that are living homeless, or the woman that I visited recently in Alabama who had been robbed by predatory lenders who charged $120,000 for a trailer at 10% interest. Then the trailer is now falling apart. Her child wears CPAC because of the mold in her home. She's disabled, and they literally have raw sewage coming out of the back of their house. In Lowes County, less than 20 miles from Selma, that's not 50 years ago, that's today. Or the Apache children I visited on the reservation in Phoenix, in Arizona, who are still hurting and struggling. Or the woman we visited whose child died in her arms because Alabama refused to expand Medicaid and she could not get medical help. Some things are not even about just being bad policies. They're just wrong. So I don't know if we so much have to change Dr. King's language, because his language was a way that you could be a person not of faith and still hear what he was saying. And the way we have framed the Poor People's Campaign, we have many people who are not of faith per se. They don't have a particular religious faith. But on the other hand, we can't let the religious community off, because we now have a reality where we have people claiming to be Christian nationalists, so-called white evangelicals, who are literally getting millions of dollars. They are promoting a particular party. They are actually going in and praying, P-R-A-Y-I-N-G, for a president and congresspeople, while those same congresspeople and president are praying, P-R-E-Y-I-N-G, on the least of these and the poor. And that requires a direct challenge of faith, because it is a form of theological malpractice and heresy.
There is misery enough to drive a Poor People's Campaign. What more do you need?
Right. What we're doing, as you know, there was just a new study that came out from the Michael Eisenhower Foundation, the second doing of the Kerner Commission, that said that many of the things that the Kerner Commission was working on had been undermined, and what we now need is a new will of the people. And so this is what we're going to be doing. On Mother's Day, we're calling all people that can to join us in 39 states. We will begin moral, nonviolent, moral fusion, direct action in 39 areas where state capitals are, plus D.C., to launch this movement. That will last for 40 straight days. And then we will be launching a massive voter mobilization, voter engagement program among the poor and the dispossessed. We will be connecting the issues of systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, militarism, and this false moral narrative as the five struggles or evil that we have to deal with in our contemporary time. We will also be building power from the bottom up among those who are most impacted. And it goes all the way to June 23rd, when there will be a massive send-off march and rally, not an end, but a telling people these are the things that we have to do from here. We need a long-term moral movement that's willing to engage in direct action as well as voter mobilization to work at changing the framework and the narrative. Our first goal, my friend, is if we do not change the narrative, we will never change the agenda. We have to shift the narrative, and the rejected, the broken, the hurting will have to lead in the reshifting of that narrative. And we all need to stand with them, not for them, to change the narrative of this country. Because when we do that, then we can work at changing the agenda and changing the direction.
If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges, because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
In the Atlantic Magazine's special memorial issue, just out on Dr. King, William Barber has a striking piece on the moral awakening he can imagine coming out of a new Poor People's Campaign. Thank you, Reverend Barber, Michael Haynes, Brandon Terry, and Michael Honey. Thanks also to Tommy Shelby, Dan Newkirk, and the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris. Visit our website, radioopensource.org, for more conversations and features. You can sign up for our newsletter there and join our Patreon community for exclusive extras, audio, t-shirts, postcards by our gifted illustrator, Susan Coyne, and lots more. We rely on the support of our listeners, so please consider making a donation. Our show was produced by the beloved community, no kidding, of Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Becca DeGregorio, and Susan Coyne, with the blessing of Frank Horton. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our holiest roller. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.